Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
An history of libraries is one in which legacy is incredibly difficult to establish, because no one cares about a library as much as its first creator. The first person who gathers the books has an intimate relationship with those books. Nobody else does.
Libraries are historically the greatest transmitters of knowledge and culture for any civilization. From the appearance of the very first collection of manuscripts to the building of the greatest temples of books, libraries have risen and invariably fallen throughout the ages. And in this time, they've played many different roles and fulfilled a variety of functions, and they continue to evolve as we speak. What is the history of libraries? What is their role? And how has that been changing? This is what my two guests today have written about. Professor Andrew Pettigrew is a historian at St. Andrews University in Scotland, where he specializes in the history of the book and media transformations. And Dr. Arthur Derivaduvan is a postdoctoral fellow, also at St. Andrews, and they co-wrote together in 2021 an engaging and deeply researched book called The Library, A Fragile History, where they investigate this institution throughout different eras and countries to reveal that libraries didn't always look like the ones we think about today, and also that they're a lot more fragile than we think. In this episode, you'll hear two different guest voices, which luckily sound quite distinct. The younger man is Arthur, whilst the voice of the elder statesman is Andrew. The two of them reveal a broad picture of the dynamics of libraries, whilst at the same time providing some truly fascinating insights into specific areas of this world. And of course, at the end, they share with us their personal recommendations on books they loved, books you've never heard of, and books that changed their minds. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you have any comments, please don't hesitate to DM me on Instagram at LitWithCharles.
What inspired you to write this book about libraries and the history of libraries? Was it a specific place that triggered your desire to write this book, or a certain event? Where did this idea come from?
Well, I think it came from the previous book that we wrote together. Arthur and I have already written a book about the book culture of the 17th century Dutch Republic. And in the course of doing the research for that book, we discovered a treasure trove of auction catalogues of private libraries. And it just occurred to us that this is a part of the story of the library which is completely missing. The history of the libraries has to this point been told largely as a story of tragedy and sadness, with the fate of institutional collections. But we became aware that not only were 99.something% of libraries accumulated in the course of history private libraries, but that very, very few of them survive, hence our sense of the fragility of the libraries. So when we see public libraries or institutional libraries rise and fall, this has been reflected more and more extensively in people's private book collections. So I think it was the sense that we had a story to tell, which is that the loss of libraries was a natural process of regeneration rather than necessarily just a tragedy, but also bring private collecting back into the center of the story, where I think we both believed it belongs.
So, in fact, your book showcases very well a lot of different phases in the development of libraries, and there were different functions to libraries over different periods of time and across regions. Some had social uses, others were more a status thing. Can you take us through some of the major transformations that libraries went through, maybe from a social thing to a work space? Or what are some of the key seminal moments that you would highlight to listeners?
Well, absolutely. It's a great question. And I think in the sort of universal history of the library, there's a lot of these moments. I think you can probably divide them by theme. And I think probably the first important one to acknowledge is just what media are used to create books. How do you actually build a library? You know, what's in a library? And if you go back to the ancient world, the first great libraries, you know, had clay tablets in them, which are incredibly durable. They can survive very well, but they're also incredibly heavy, very cumbersome to move. So that, in some ways, dictates how libraries will be shaped, because it requires a lot of space. It requires institutional power to protect them and to create them. Now, if you move on to where books are being created on papyrus scrolls, or indeed much later by the medieval era on paper, both those are incredibly cheap to produce in comparison to, say, great clay tablets or vellum parchments, which have been created from animal skins. So I think those transitions of bookmaking are incredibly important to deciding who libraries are for, who can actually begin to build libraries, and indeed how you store them. We often, when we think of a library, we think of upright shelves. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the normal way that we do libraries. But, you know, for a large part of the history of the library, people keep their libraries in chests, for example. Mm-hmm. And that was often because if you had a book collection of 50 or 100 books, they would be incredibly valuable, and you wouldn't just want them on open shelves where they, you know, they can get dirty more easily, they can go missing more easily. They were treasured. So you keep them in a chest like you do jewelry or other valuable things, you know, the charters to your land or your home. That's what you keep with your library. So I think that's a very important phase of transition in library. And of course, it also affects us now that today we are storing so much library content online in a digital form, which in many ways is probably one of the most fragile forms of storing books, of curating a library.
I did like in your book how clear it was that the fate of the library is inextricably tied to the development and survival of books, the resilience of books. And so, as you said, the books went from being treasures that were stored in chests to having more public display. Presumably, that's due to the most significant development in the history of books, which is the invention of the printing press by Johannes Gutenberg, which really revolutionized the production and quantities of books. And in fact, you write an insane statistic in your book, which is more books had been created in the last 100 years, and this is in 1650, than in the whole history of mankind to this point. So how did libraries face this explosion in production? I mean, presumably they must have had to start building a lot of new buildings and treat the book in a very different way than they had up till then. Can you tell us a little bit about that development?
Certainly. I mean, I think the important thing to recognize is there were mixed results. You know, the invention of printing, first of all, it was a major step forward for what you might see as a long-term democratization of library building. If books are so much easier to produce and to create, and it becomes cheaper over time with mass production, also with the introduction of paper, then all of a sudden many more people can begin to build small collections. And that's one of the key themes in our book, that actually the invention of printing is the greatest boon, first of all, to private collecting. And that continues on into today, you know, and that's something that's often not recognized. The sheer quantity of books that are privately owned and sitting in people's homes is directly associated with the mass production of books that begins with the invention of print. But this really is only one side of the story. So I don't know if Andrew wants to address the other part.
Well, yes. I mean, what I think we came to understand was that this great increase in the capacity to produce books as a result of print was only possible if printers, authors, and customers all recognized this needed a drastic reframing of what a book is. In the first years of printing, this was an incredibly conservative industry. It produced largely the sort of books which would have been produced as manuscripts, because they did not want to alienate the current owners of manuscripts by presenting this workaday black-white object and say, this is an alternative to your lovely manuscripts. that didn't work because the market was too small. Building the distribution network was a major invention in itself. So what kept print alive was printing single sheet proclamations for the various states and princes, working for the church, and then, of course, the pamphlet revolution that came with Martin Luther. So the whole idea of what constituted a book was completely reshaped. And I think it's only in the 21st century that we've understood the sheer scope of this. And I think one of the problems with earlier histories of printing and indeed the library was that this was before the digital age, before we'd had major cataloging projects like the Universal Short Title Catalog, which could show how much of this work was workaday printing, which was never intended for the shelves of a library. But when our earlier generation, the pioneers of book history, wrote, they were writing in an environment where essentially, if you work from the major libraries only, if you divide your time between the British Library, the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and Harvard, you think it's all about great big books and innovative discoveries, whereas in fact, it's the sort of everyday work of producing 100 copies of the latest bread prices for the municipal council, which actually keeps the profits coming in and sustains the industry. And that also lies behind what we were writing, because the whole concept of an institutional library is really difficult to sustain through the first years of print. This is partly because private collectors, why do they need a public institution when he can build their own collection of several hundred, several thousand books? And why so many people are exposed to print without owning a single book? One of the most extraordinary things that Arthur and I found in the course of writing our book about the book culture of the Dutch Golden Age was that close to three quarters of every item produced, three quarters of all the different editions, were given away free rather than sold. And when you think in those terms, you realize that what we think of as the normal life of a book, it's printed, it goes to the binders, the owner buys it and then goes and reads it sequentially, that's actually very rare in the history of printed artifacts.
It's a very modern invention.
It is, but even today, although that's the way we read novels, it's not necessarily the way we use books as point of reference. The books that surround me in this room are not really intended for sequential reading in that way. Someone once said that probably in the history of the book, only about one-tenth of books conform to that expected pattern of reading.
I mean, that's some phenomenal stats right there. And it's what I loved in your book was, it was this feeling that a lot of the things that we take for granted with regard to our relationship to books and libraries were actually fairly recent developments. And these developments were driven by a certain number of individuals. One of the individuals that caught my attention in your book was Fernando Colon, who was the son of Christopher Columbus, who knew that Christopher Columbus had a son who had been such a major force in the development of libraries. Can you tell us why he's so important? What exactly was his great achievement? I mean, he was amassing huge collections, but more specifically, how do you think he drove the development of libraries?
Well, the most important thing about Fernand Colomus was he was his meticulous bookkeeping. He had this view of recreating the Library of Alexandria, creating a universal library, which is an incredibly strong trope all the way through history. Even in the French Revolution, when the revolutionary armies were making hay in Germany, the librarian of the new Bibliothèque Nationale said, "It is our intention to use this opportunity to build a universal library." That idea is very strong. But alongside that idea, you get a continuous history of failure. Columbus failed. He tried to build a universal library, sighted it down in Seville, where no one was going to go on by accident, so it was a terrible place for it. And then in his will, he made provisions for its maintenance, which mostly relied on other people paying. An history of libraries is one in which legacy is incredibly difficult to establish, because no one cares about a library as much as its first creator. The first person who gathers the books has an intimate relationship with those books. Nobody else does.
That's a recurrent theme in your book, is the obliteration of libraries. As soon as the original constructor of that library dies, it's a very quick process for the disintegration of that collection.
So what you see with Cologne is one of the first stages of a process which really exists from the 15th century to the 19th century. And that's the failure to find a model for the institutional library which works for the people for whom it's intended.
Now, you're both located in Scotland, and fun fact that I discovered while preparing this, Edinburgh is the city in the world with the highest number of libraries per capita. You do mention a little bit Scotland in your book and the development of libraries with James Kirkwood. What is that history, for the sake of our listeners? How did it become so important in Scotland to develop this culture of libraries?
So I think one of the key reasons why Scotland has so many libraries, why it has such a rich literary history too, and a lot of it has to do with the early and very high literacy rates. And that's a key development in the history of book collecting in general. If a country or a region doesn't have very high literacy rates, there's a natural limit to how many libraries you'll be able to build up as a country. Because if people don't read, they're not going to access books and enter libraries. Because of the Reformation and a lot of the sort of early transformations in schooling in Scotland, already from the 16th and 17th century onwards, there was a real sense that books were part of everyday people's lives. At the same time, Scotland, as a country of producers of books and print, was more on the European periphery for a very long time. And so you get a lot of energy, and this is the case of this one Presbyterian minister, James Kirkwood, who essentially sees the deliberate planting and building up of libraries as a means to enlighten Scotland, to create this very highly literate, prosperous nation. If we only just create libraries, people will become knowledgeable, they will become better Protestants and more useful citizens, and so forth. So there's a real sense in this sort of great belief in the book and the library as a vehicle of progress. So I think that's crucial. It should be said that, again, as Andrew just hinted at, it's also a story of failure. Kirkwood didn't really succeed. Firstly, because he wanted to create essentially a centralized library depot in Scotland that would require all his fellow ministers to hand over their book collections to him, for him then to reorganize and redistribute. Well, you can imagine, you know, book collectors, no, that just doesn't work, right? So he came up with a second plan, which was to establish Protestant libraries in areas of the Scottish Highlands, which were then still very Catholic. Now, he did actually raise a lot of money for this, because there were many other Protestants, especially in England, in London, who did see this as a useful venture, very much also a political goal, because if you create good Protestants in Scotland, you're no longer going to have political insurrection. That was the thinking. However, he established, you know, over 50 libraries in the Scottish Highlands with this money, but, you know, within decades, they had all disappeared, or they were all decaying and crumbling down. And the reason for that was that people don't take kindly to libraries if they are being forced upon them, if they have books that they have no interest in reading. And that's another theme that runs throughout our book, is that libraries will only survive and thrive if there is a certain buy-in from the community, if there are actually people that use them rather than just look at them as a symbol of what it might represent.
It's interesting that throughout the book, the libraries are shown as prime targets of destruction, devastation, when there's a war, when there's a revolution. It seems that the library is the first thing that people want to burn down. What are some of the most tragic losses that you see in the history of libraries across history? What are some of the most egregious examples of a library that was burnt to the ground because of a major event?
Well, perhaps I would think that the most egregious was the destruction of the library in Jaffa in Sri Lanka in 1981, because this was not during a war, but it was a deliberate attack on the central repository of Tamil culture. And it played a large part in initiating a war. Otherwise, I'd be very happy to disentangle the two words tragic and loss.
Uh-huh.
Not every destruction of a library is a tragedy. And books are not just mute, innocent parties in this. And this is a theme I come to in my next book, The Book at War, on books in wartime. Not only how books provide comfort to readers in wartime, which they do, but also how they are themselves the munitions of war. Books are used to create a cause. They're used to denigrate their enemies. They're essential tools in war making, whether it's the libraries of scientific periodicals in all of the combatant nations, or the books that newspapers and magazines that are poured through by intelligence specialists to understand their enemies, or indeed the maps, which are the cartographical expression of national aspiration and therefore often themselves the causes of conflicts between nations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is an understanding. We are all bookish people. We all approve of books and think everybody else should approve of books. But would we really have wanted the 9 million copies of Hitler's Mein Kampf that had been circulated in Germany by 1945 to remain on the shelves of German libraries? I don't think we would. Actually, Germans mostly took care of that problem themselves by using it for fuel in their stoves during the cold months of 1945 after their defeat. But the inherent assumption that books are good, therefore libraries are good, therefore they should always be saved, is one which actually doesn't stand up to historical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
When books were often the cause of circulating poisonous ideologies, there was a reason why so many young men in all the combatant nations flocked to the recruiting stations in 1914, and it was often because of what they'd read, what they believed about their own country, and what they believed about other countries that made them into antagonists. So a lot of that loss is no great tragedy.
A slightly, I would say, contrarian opinion to what people might expect. So let me follow up with a question about the book you just mentioned, The Book at War. The main thesis of the book, then, it seems from what you've just said, is that books are or can be an instrument of war with sometimes nefarious outcomes.
Absolutely. And we go through the whole range of people who read in wartime. Publishers like nothing better than a captive audience. And to some extent, wartime gives them plenty. People who are stationed in remote billets, continents away from home, prisoners of war, the most obvious captive audience, and people who are even at home but deprived of family and use this as a form of comfort. But then we deal with the more obvious part of the story, which is the destruction through bombing and artillery. We deal with plunder, and therefore we deal also with restitution after the end of the wars and where that's possible and where that's not possible. So we try and go through the whole experience of books in a time of war, but also what happens between wars when people are both analyzing the last war and preparing for the next war.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the 20th century, which occupies the main part of this story, is when you have wars being fought between literate nations, fully literate nations. And that's a new phenomenon because even in the 19th century, something like 40% of the soldiers in the British Army could not read. But that's transformed by mass education in the second half of the 19th century. And so armies can't rely on soldiers which simply do what they're told because they are told to do it. You get citizen conscript armies where it's important that the case for war be made to them and continuously made for them, and that they're promised a better tomorrow at the end of the war. And that's very important, particularly in the democracies. We deal with the slight difference in the way books operate in democracies and dictatorships. That's very important. And we recognize that not only are populations very literate, but The Second World War is very unusual in it's waged between leaders who are themselves authors. We've talked about Hitler and Mein Kampf. Winston Churchill won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Stalin was a much underrated writer and a considerable intellectual. Charles de Gaulle wrote a very important text on mechanized warfare. And in terms of sales, they were all blown out of the water by Chairman Mao and his Little Red Book, which circulated in up to a billion copies worldwide.
Somewhat forceful sales.
Well, every married couple in Germany got given a copy of Mein Kampf as part of their celebration. So I think a lot of those sales weren't so voluntary either.
Yeah, forced as well. I'm curious, so the book at war, do you have any insight? For example, on the most contemporary conflict we're seeing right now, which is the Ukraine war, what are you seeing there? Are you getting any information on how books are playing a role or might have played a role? Or has there been any noticeable destruction of books or libraries in this latest conflict?
Well, that's a very interesting question because it's emerging that although in terms of weaponry, this is a very 21st century war, in terms of its impact on book culture, you see many of the same themes that we've explored in the history of war and books coming to the fore again. For instance, in the occupied regions of Ukraine, in the Donbass and so forth, the occupiers had already begun, since 2014, removing Ukrainian books from the library. Now that conflict is joined in the unoccupied part of Ukraine, Russian books have been removed from libraries. And private citizens are surrendering their Russian books at collection points to go off for pulping to be made into other artifacts, whether it's books or other forms of things which you need paper or cardboard. So we can see the war being fought in the public and also the private libraries of the people of Ukraine. And this is a country which, before the war at least, a large portion of its intellectuals and its population as a whole were native Russians. And they're flocking to courses to learn Ukrainian so that they can be more fully integrated into the life of a country which may, in the event, become more monolingual as a result of that. Or let's say if there is a second language of Ukraine, it's likely to be English rather than Russian. So yes, an enormous impact. There's been many libraries which are collateral damage. Mm-hmm. Of the bombings. There has been some libraries which have clearly been directly targeted. And this is one aspect of war which is relatively new, that the greater precision of rockets and cruise missiles and modern weaponry makes it much more difficult to claim that the destruction of a library or a civic building or a hospital was an accident.
In terms of contemporary libraries today in the world, what would you say is the biggest or the quote-unquote best library in the world, according to which standards? What's a library that you find inspiring and delivering on the promise to spread a love of literature and books? Are there any that stand out in your mind as symbols of excellence?
To me, it's a difficult question because if you were to limit it to simply say, you know, what are the biggest libraries, then definitely easily it's the likes of the Library of Congress, for example, Washington, D.C., the British Library in London, definitely both stand out as very, very large collections that also have a very broad collection.
Right.
So both of those very deliberately, very early in their history, already in the 19th and early 20th century, made it a mission to collect as many books in other languages than their own, and books about other countries and by foreign authors, etc. So the British Library especially had a sort of early mission to say, we want to have the largest collection of Spanish books outside of Spanish libraries and Dutch books outside of Dutch libraries and so forth. And in many ways, they have succeeded in that regard. So those are inspiring in that sense, and they have an enormous amount of printed holdings. They also have great electronic holdings. On the other hand, in from my personal experience as a researcher and studying all these libraries with Andrew, what does come out is that often the bigger the library, the more difficult they can be.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, first of all, they have so much in their holdings. There's often a lot that's uncatalogued. There's often a lot that is very poorly catalogued. And at the same time, you know, they tend to be slightly more bureaucratic institutions. Whereas, you know, if I go to a much smaller public library, to a provincial archive that may have books and prints, you get a very warm welcome because the librarian archivist will have an immense knowledge of what they have and they will be very interested in what you're doing. So you often have much more, as a scholar or a reader, you have a much more intimate relationship with an institution in that way.
So it seems that's a metric for you to gauge the excellence of a library is the strength of the relationship with the individuals in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. The openness of the library, its accessibility, because if you don't know what a library has, if you have no way of starting your journey in the library, you're going to have a difficult time. And then secondly, the librarians and the expertise of the librarians and their willingness to share their collections with users. Those are, I think, the two key things.
Now, the book ends on a note of optimism. And again, you highlight that the fate of the library is very much tied to the fate of the book, and that the book, despite its simple appearance, is a remarkable interface that has survived so long and seen off, as you write, so many competing technologies like the CD-ROM, like the Kindle, and so on. But on the flip side, you write in that final chapter as well about the work of Google in amassing and digitizing the world's knowledge in the digital realm. And we know separately that AI is making leaps and bounds in the news these days. Can the library really survive all these technological leaps? I mean, when all the world's information can hold on a microchip, what will be the use of walking into a big building that's full of paper books? Do you really see that resilience carrying on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think libraries and the physical book will outlast all this tech and these developments. And I think for probably two key reasons. The first one is the tactile experience. People will continue to flock to books because it's such a nice medium. It's so good on the eyes. It's better for your memory. You can still travel very easily with it. You can curl up with it in a nice chair on the sofa. It's very durable, as we discussed. And that ties into the second reason, that so much of this technology is still incredibly fragile. It may now work extremely well, but you know, think first of all of the sort of global energy crisis that we have, which underpins all digital technology. And second of all, when you think, you just mentioned microchips, you know, at some point, the resources we extract from the earth to make all these microchips are going to run out, or they're going to become more expensive or more difficult to get hold of. You know, what do you do then? I'll still be very comforted by all the physical books that I have in my office and in my home that will survive for centuries after I'm gone if people continue to take decent care of them.
So on that note, I mean, I do outsource to my community on Instagram sometimes questions for the people I'm interviewing, and sometimes I do get some good questions. And one of my followers asked, is there a doomsday vault beyond the electronic digitized systems for physical books?
Well, you should tell your friend that his home, my home, Arthur's home, this is our doomsday bunker. Because whenever books are destroyed in large numbers, they find their safety in the collections we've all incidentally put together in our homes. So if you say, which I think is fair, that 500 million books were destroyed in the Second World War in private and public institutions, that seems like an awful lot. But in the 2 years, 1940 and 1941, Germany alone published 580 million copies of books. So wow. This is one of these cases where the cost of replenishment sort of matches the cost of destruction. You know, if you think to destroy a statue, the cost of reconstruction is greatly more than the cost of destruction. All you need is a strong guy with a hammer and bing, it's gone. Whereas with books, because you know each edition has thousands or hundreds of copies, reconstituting what is lost is actually very plausible because each item lost is not unique.
Mm-hmm.
So the Doomsday Vault, in this respect, has been subcontracted to all of us.
Outsourced to all of us.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, coming back to that digital versus physical copies, do you have broad insights into what the numbers are these days between people consuming electronic books and physical books? Is that battle between electronic and physical showing any signs of being won by one side or the other? Or what are the latest trends you see on that front?
Well, we do know with respect to our own books, because we get statements from the publisher, and I can say that of all the books I've published as trade books, and all the books that Art and I have together have published as trade books, never more than 10% of the sales are in media other than hardcover books or paperback books.
I see.
I think that will be a much wider trend too. I mean, I think it's safe to say that people consume an enormous amount of digital information. And certainly when it comes to news, for example, you know, some of the slightly more ephemeral information that we see printed for centuries, that might be shifting. But the actual book, and whether that's nonfiction or fiction, print continues to be very, very strong. The statistic that's definitely still the case is that every year, as we progress into the future, every year more printed books are published than the year before in the history of the world.
Wow.
And that hasn't been changing. So I don't see digital or the ebook winning out as long as that trend continues.
So now we're going to move to our quick question section, where I ask you about your personal tastes and what you've read recently, and hope to get some advice and recommendations on your end about what you like and don't like. And I'll start with my favorite question, which is, what is your favorite book that I've never heard of?
Well, I doubt you've heard of Wolfgang Beringer's Turn und Taxis, which is a study of the beginnings of the postal service in Europe. I'm fairly confident of this because it's never been translated from German.
Uh-huh.
But it's 450 pages, is worth poring over in some detail because it's a fantastic book.
And it's the Turn and Taxis family and business was, the as you said, the development of the postal service.
That's right. The Turn and Taxis family were basically given by the Holy Roman Empire the monopoly on the running of an international courier service for him. But they were allowed, crucially, to allow other people to use this service as well. So commercial customers were allowed to make use of the same service. So it was a huge investment for them, but it made them very rich indeed when it succeeded, creating the infrastructure.
What about you, Arthur? Any hidden gems that you like to recommend to friends and family?
Hidden gem. It's a sort of quasi-historical memoir. It's a book called The Forgotten Soldier, originally written in French, Le Soldat Oublié, by a guy called Guy Sayer, which is a sort of account of a private soldier in the German Wehrmacht in the end of the Second World War. And it's extremely depressing. It's sort of written as a truthful historical account, and it's clear that there are some omissions or slight fictionalization. And yeah, so I definitely recommend that.
Sounds brutal and depressing indeed, but thank you for sharing that. What's a great book that you've read recently that you would recommend? And that could be a more mainstream choice. In the last 12 months, have you read anything that you've particularly appreciated and would recommend?
Well, I should start by saying loyally that I greatly enjoyed Arthur's new book on state communication and public politics in the Dutch Golden Age.
What a good teammate you are.
I would recommend that to everyone. I try and read at home, alternating between a fiction book and a non-fiction book.
Mm-hmm.
So a recent book of fiction, historical fiction, which I've hugely enjoyed, was S.G. MacLean's The Bookseller of Inverness.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful, wonderful book set in the aftermath of the failure of the Jacobite Rising of 1745. Beautifully plotted, wholly believable characterizations. And I would say, important for me in a book, there has to be someone I can root for. There has to be someone whose side I'm on. And if all the characters in the book are so ghastly that you say, well, you know, they can all go as far as I'm concerned, then it's not a successful read for me.
Very interesting. Fairly standard approach. I think many people do prefer books where they can get behind a certain person or at least their cause. What about you, Arthur? Any books lately that you've read?
Definitely. I mean, very much keeping on the theme of Ukraine we discussed earlier, I read Sergei Plokhii's Gates of Europe, A History of Ukraine, which is a long durée history of Ukraine from its earliest beginnings to the present day. And that's an extremely illuminating and enlightening read. And certainly, I think if anyone wants to understand the current conflict in the world, it's very helpful to take that along with you.
That sounds like a phenomenal book.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that question, what is a book that you've read recently that you found disappointing? And you're allowed to name names. This is a transparent podcast.
Well, I'm gonna start it, and I'm not going to go for a nonfiction book. I'm actually going to pick a fiction book this time. I'm a good fan of Hemingway. And I recently read for the first time his work, To Have and Have Not. I'd read his Old Man and the Sea, and I enjoyed the description of Caribbean fishing and tribulations, etc., the drama and cessation of that. And this is very much set in the same sort of era setting.
Yeah.
And it just didn't do it for me.
Interesting.
And I'm unlike Andrew, I don't mind a book where there's just bad people everywhere and there's no conclusion and it's just sad. But no, and this is very much one of those books, but I couldn't get it.
Not for you.
Not for me.
Thank you for that. What about you, Andrew? What was your big disappointment?
Well, I'm going to disappoint you as far as disappointing books are concerned, because if they're disappointing, I just put them down and don't continue.
Uh-huh.
I've got no scruples about giving up a book. And sometimes a book only lasts for me as long as it takes me to read a couple of pages down in our local bookshop. And if I don't like the look of it, I just don't read it.
So, fair enough. What single book would you take to a desert island?
I have to be terribly boring here because I would probably take War and Peace because it's the only chance it has of me reading it.
Uh-huh.
I bought it at the start of the COVID epidemic thinking this is my chance. But even then, I didn't get into it. I had a house full of other books to read first. But since this is a desert island question, I'm going to insist that I take the copy previously owned by Andrew Carnegie. Since he's a Scot, he's a man of Fife, which is where we work in St. Andrews, and his contribution to finally finding a way to make public libraries work is one of the few examples where you can say this man transformed something.
One of the huge influences in your book, a major character in the development of libraries, Andrew Carnegie. And so by association, his copy of War and Peace would make it that much more valuable on a desert island.
And that much more, me much more determined to get through it in those circumstances.
What about you, Arthur?
I think probably take one of my favorite fiction books that I could just read over and over again, and that would be Scoop by Evelyn Waugh,
mm-hmm.
which is an excellent romp, great satire of journalism and news culture. And as someone who knows a little bit about newspapers and has written about them in the past, I really, really enjoyed
it. A great reread, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And finally, our final question today, what book changed your mind?
Well, here I'll take it back to libraries again. And that was one of the books read for our library book. And that is a book called Double Fold by the author Nicholson Baker, which is a truly excellent book, a bit of a sort of crusading book, because it's essentially an investigation into the reasons why so many American public library collections decided to destroy their historic stock of newspapers from the 19th and in some ways early 20th century. And it's a big sort of attack on the microfilm as a replacement technology for print. And I think it really ties into this anxiety of, it really very much persuaded me that, you know, technology isn't necessarily progress, isn't necessarily the answer. And sometimes by trying to save something, we can end up destroying it.
Very interesting. Yeah, that was a theme in one of the mentions in your book around microfilms being a bit more ephemeral than originally expected. And you, Andrew, what book changed your mind?
Well, I certainly agree with what Arthur said about Double Fold. It is a book which really does change your view where it comes to whether it's actually safe to destroy material in libraries and rely on technologies which themselves turn out to be not a great improvement. As for me, I would probably, what changed my mind? Certainly the book I mentioned in my first answer on the Postal Service changed my mind, because it brought home to me actually that we too often treat the history of communication of one of new forms of communication which supersede previous forms of communication. And what Wolfgang Berlinger's book made clear to me was that in this age of print, with all this printed material circulating, old style forms of communication, such as correspondence and handwritten newsletters, remained probably for two centuries the most important form of public communication. So I think that can be applied to the history of communication more generally. And Arthur and I have a plan to write a history of communication from the singing Neanderthal to TikTok, because that tells you the truth is that we have too much anxiety about new communication mechanisms. Television did not kill the book. Radio did not kill the newspaper. Cinema did not kill theater. But why should we be surprised? Because when people started writing back in ancient times, they didn't stop talking. So the history of communication is a cumulative process rather than sequential. And I think a lot of the doomsday prognostications come from a failure to understand that central but often forgotten circumstance of the human existence.
Well, on those wise words, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure speaking to you about your book, The Library, A Fragile History, and about the topic of libraries in general. Absolutely fascinating insights. Thanks to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Charles.
Here's a quick recap of the books mentioned throughout the episode. The Book at War by Andrew Pettigrew, one of the co-writers and guests of this podcast. That's his latest book published in 2023, and it explores the role that books have played in conflicts. When I asked them what their favorite book was that I'd never heard of, Andrew's answer was Turn und Taxis by Wolfgang Berlinger, published in 1990, which is the history of the family behind the world's first postal service. Sadly, it's not translated into English. Arthur's favorite book that I'd never heard of was The Forgotten Soldier by Guy Sayer, published in 1965, which is the autobiographical account of a French Alsatian man fighting in the German army on the Eastern Front in World War II. When I asked them what was the best book that they'd read in the last 12 months, Andrew mentioned the book State Communications and Public Politics in the Dutch Golden Age by his co-writer Arthur Der Verduven, published in 2023. And he also mentioned The Bookseller of Inverness by S.G. MacLean, published in 2022, which is set in Scotland in the aftermath of the Jacobite Rebellion of 1745. Arthur's best book in the last 12 months was The Gates of Europe, A History of Ukraine by Serhii Plocky, published in 2015. What book disappointed them in the last 12 months? Andrew said that he doesn't read bad books. He discards them if he's not into them. But Arthur replied the novel To Have and Have Not by Ernest Hemingway, published in 1937. What book would they take to a desert island? Andrew's answer was War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, published in 1867. And he specifically wanted a copy that was owned by Andrew Carnegie, who was a huge contributor to the development of public libraries and a major figure, therefore, in their book, The Library, A Fragile History. Arthur's answer was Scoop by Evelyn Waugh, published in 1938, which is a satire of journalism and news culture. And finally, the book that changed their mind for Andrew was, again, Turn und Taxis by Wolfgang Berlinger, which made him realize that traditional forms of communication are more resilient than we think, and that these transformations are generally a cumulative rather than a destructive process. For Arthur, the book that changed his mind was Doublefold by Nicholson Baker, published in 2001, which is an investigation as to why so many libraries destroyed their stock of newspaper archives, which convinced him that technology in the world of libraries is not necessarily progress.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account, @LitWithCharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.